Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the Internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, as well as their yearly writers' conference, please go to pnwa.org. And, you know, the reason I do this show, really, and have these conversations is that I am a firm believer, just as I said in my little intro, that what it takes to the book you want to write is what it takes to lead the life you want to lead, that we're really learning how to live life creatively when we learn how to write, how to create the life we want to lead. And I think it's critical that when we do anything creative to know why we're doing it, to be in constant contact with the real reason we do things, which is never simply to make money. I simply decline to accept that. And I think that when you forget this, it gets very hard to do anything valuable and creative in your life. And so that's sort of my passion, what I like to teach. And I'll be teaching a class on that very subject this Saturday at the Writer's Workshop in Port Townsend, Washington. It's called Why We Write. And I believe there's still some seats available if you want to grab a seat at the table. Also, if you wanted to have me come speak to your writing class or your writing organization or your writer's group or even work with you individually, I'm always happy to do that as well. And you can find out about that at williamknauer.com. It's williamknauer.com. And, of course, if you don't have time to have me come speak to you directly, you can always pick up a copy of Write Within Yourself, an author's companion, available where all fine books are sold. All right, well, I don't know. I don't even need to do that much of an intro with today's guest. It's Diane Hammond. I just love this woman. I got to meet her first time when she released Hannah's Dream. She did not know at that time would be her first bestseller, but it was, and it was well worth it. And I really enjoyed talking to her, and she was, I think, my second or maybe third guest on Author to Author. I knew immediately I wanted her included in this, and so I had her on here a year ago. And now she's just released the sequel, actually, her first ever sequel to Hannah's Dream, Friday's Harbor, and I could not get her on the show. She's funny, she's smart, she's honest, and she's here with us now. She's Diane Hammond. Diane, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bill. I'm really glad to be back.
Oh, it's good to have you back, Diane. How does it well, first of all, I know you've relocated to the middle of the country where it's either very, very hot or very, very cold.
Yes. Yes, I'm now a proud resident of St. Paul, Minnesota. Thank you very much. But I'll tell you, my geography, my personal geography from east to west goes Minnesota, Idaho, Washington. I cut out all the intervening states. It's my game of denial that I really am not that far from home. Even here in Minnesota, I'm still getting used to the idea that I might one day be called a Midwestern writer. I don't think so, though.
I don't think so. You seem to be a very Northwest or a West Coast writer, and of course, got another book out on the West Coast, and how does it feel? You've written a sequel, and how did it feel to write that book?
Frankly, it was a tough one.
Was it?
I wasn't really convinced that what a sequel meant. And so I had to figure out, okay, who do I bring over essentially from Hannah's Dream of the characters, and who do I create from scratch, and who's going to do the heavy lifting in this book? And I'll bet that was half the battle, was just trying to answer those questions, but in an organic way that felt right, instead of just sort of legislating, okay, well, we'll keep Truman and we'll get rid of Harriet. And, you know, it had to happen differently than that. So, It was tough.
Yeah, and you know it doesn't work that way. You can make all the intellectual decisions you want, but, I mean, all those characters in Hannah's Dream appeared to you, so many of them, mm-hmm. and really you found them as you were going. And so you can make all the intellectual decisions you want, but something's going to happen that you didn't predict.
It's so true. Just because you say it's going to happen doesn't mean it's going to happen. So I ended up starting to write it thinking one thing, and then when I finally relaxed enough to just let my characters come to me instead of my searching for them, it got fun again. And from the moment it got fun to the moment I finished it, it was a very positive experience. It's a weird thing to say, though. This is a sequel, but it's not really a sequel because Hannah, of course, the elephant, isn't in this book. And there's a different animal entirely that's the main frame of the thing.
You worked – wait a minute. You were in publicity. You worked for the – who? Okay, you worked for the – what? Who was the whale you worked for? You worked for a whale.
Yeah, you're right. I worked for Keiko, who was the killer whale from Free Willy that ended up, and it was, I think it was 16 years ago now, came up to the Oregon Coast Aquarium in Newport, and I ended up, through sheer dumb luck, being his press secretary for a couple of years. And that was quite an experience, and in the end, that's the animal that I chose to bring with me into the sequel.
Yeah.
He's a killer whale named Friday. But a lot of him is really based on Keiko's character.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting thing writing about animals because, of course, they don't have the quite – well, I mean, obviously they don't have a human imagination exactly, but there is such an emotional intelligence, especially in large animals. I mean, I'm not saying they're not in, they don't exist in small animals, but there is a – there is an intelligence in them that is – it's harder to is it harder to write? What do you think? Is it harder to connect to as a writer?
I don't know. I mean, my feeling is they have a huge presence, and I certainly believe they have a soul. But interpreting minute to minute or encounter to encounter what exactly is going on in there is really tough. And with Hannah, I actually knew much less about elephants than I do about killer whales, and in some ways. She was easier to create as a character because I just decided that these were the things I knew about her, and I kind of gave her a soul, but I didn't start with one that was afforded me. But with Keiko, who turned into Friday, I knew a lot more about him from having watched every day for 2 years, and in some ways, dealing with reality and trying to transcend it to create a character, not a literal moment-to-moment timeline, is much harder than I thought it would be. And in fact, that was one of the challenges of the book, was to hold on to some of the characteristics and experiences that I watched Keiko have, but not to be beholden to those things and therefore write a really tedious kind of character who would only appeal to a real killer whale lover out there. And hopefully I did that well, but it was harder than I expected it would be.
You know, it reminds me of something one can go through writing human characters as well, which is, it's not unusual, I think, although maybe you don't do this, but to when you begin a character, to start sort of around someone you've known, maybe. Base it very, you know, very loosely, you've met someone or maybe even your own family or whatever, and to sort of start there, but you for sure can't end there.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be simply just to allow that nucleus of a person to become something different in the book. And isn't that sort of what we do with our fictional, all our fictional characters?
Yeah, I certainly do. I'm answering for myself only. And where you start isn't at all what you're going to know about them by the end. I mean, it's kind of like an onion. And I never know, I really don't know my characters until they write themselves. So you're kind of, well, I guess it's an onion in reverse. You start with a little nucleus, and then you layer and layer and layer as you learn more and more about them. And by the end, you have a big onion. But it doesn't happen kind of all at once on note cards. At least it doesn't to me. I'm kind of channeling for my characters as I go along.
I'll tell you, Diane, I find it endlessly, mysteriously fascinating how these things happen. That this language that we use over and over again of they write themselves, and I found them, and then I learned who they are, while you're the only one there at the computer, wherever it is you write.
Right.
And yet that's just what it is. That's just what it is.
Yeah, it's really almost a mystical, well, and it, you know, it, It is. It's kind of mystical. You just sort of commune with your brain, but you channel. I mean, you're channeling. On a good day, you know this too, on a good day, it's just like magic. And on a bad day, you eat a lot. At least I eat a lot because you aren't in control. So, you know, I have oyster crackers all over my office, and I eat if it's not working easily. And there are a lot more eating days than really, truly magical ones, but it's not a controllable process.
No, you know, I was just talking to some high school students today, and I think what I was saying was to go in straight over their heads, but it doesn't matter because I'm going through it too, which is that old Greek metaphor of the muse.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely applicable because I've come – in fact, you know what, Diane, it's interesting. You were the first person I ever interviewed where I talked about this, where I just started thinking about writing as listening, that the entire experience, not just to characters but to everything, is listening. And I've come to view writing as a relationship with my
mm-hmm.
imagination, not this thing. I'm not – you know, just like any good imagination, I've got to be present and I got to listen and be open to what that offers.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, that's a really interesting way of thinking about it as a relationship. I hadn't really thought that about it that way, but it's absolutely true. And we are in love with our writing selves too. Some days, you know, the relationship is working perfectly, but then there are those other days when, you know, your creative presence just isn't, and you're left there feeling flat-footed and hoping to God the next day is going to be more productive. At least that happens to me.
Oh, my God. It's the unknown. Poor writers. You know, we love to do this, but you know that. You know it. You're going to that desk like you don't know what's going to be there. And don't you know you can have, like, you could be standing in your shower one more and say, oh, I got the best idea. And then you go to the desk, and you don't know until that idea is on the paper if it really is such a great idea, do you?
Yeah. No, absolutely not. And I think in some ways I envy nonfiction writers, good nonfiction writers. They are, of course, creative, too, in a different way. But they know what the story is. At least they know most of it.
Yeah, I know. Let me tell you something. No, I'm going to interrupt you, Diane, like a bad host, because I've been writing nonfiction for the last 3 years. I've been writing memoir stuff. And even though I do know the story, you don't really know. You know what happened, but that's not the story.
Right.
And
no,
so,
I guess that's true.
No, it's the same. I realized I thought it was. Then when I really started doing it, I found, no, it's a different kind of searching. It's true. You're not finding characters. You're not finding the story. But in a way, you are finding the story. Because I would write a scene that had happened to me 8 times, so it finally felt like what actually happened to me. And I had to find it, and even though it happened to me. But it's a little different, but in the end, it's the same thing.
Well, and you still are creating a reality for somebody else to experience,
right.
And whether it's based on the truth or actual experience or it's not, I guess that wouldn't really matter. I mean, that part of
doesn't.
The process is the same. So,
end, it doesn't really matter. But it's there is something particular, though. There is something particular about the character, about the person that isn't you that's talking to you, that is still a little different, where did they come from kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I love my characters. And the ones, if I don't love them really quickly, they're not a real character and they've shown the door. The ones that are going to work for me, you do have to fall in love. You do have to worry about them and try to accept and interpret all the things that you would a dear friend or a family member. And by the end of the book, they really are a piece of you. Somebody was asking me the other day about, what do I do with my characters when the book is done? Which I thought was a pretty interesting question.
It is.
And I hang on to them. I mean, I don't show them out of the house. You know, I'm not necessarily engaged with them much, but they're definitely a piece of me, and they have that home for as long as I'm alive. Some of the good ones do come back from time to time, so and not in a sequel either, but I mean into our own consciousness. Do you have that same feeling? Would you answer that question?
It's a good question. I was just thinking about it as you were describing it. I think that that's really true because if you found a real character, it's really an aspect of yourself in a way, I think, that is given voice, given a complete voice. And it's almost like a chance to really see that part of yourself in action.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what it reminds me of is even as I've written nonfiction, I have to empathize with all these people I've known and try to write from their – even though I'm writing from my perspective, I have to learn to understand them
mm-hmm.
as best I can and to see the world anew from what their perspective might have been.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I do that, I feel as though I have been expanded in some way.
Mm-hmm.
The way one does when one really finds a character – when you really find a character, you feel like you've – I feel like a window has been opened for me somehow. Into the,
mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
And how could you close
it? And here's another
then?
Question, another way to think about it. Do you believe that we are actors? Are writers actors except in an interior way?
Yes, absolutely. I used to do theater, and absolutely.
Uh-huh.
I think
so too, but it's hard to articulate. But we have to be able to act. Our characters have to act with each other, and we have to be able to act on any one of their behalfs. And so, yeah, I agree with you. I think that it has a lot to do with being an actor. We simply are doing it inside us, where people can't see and laugh at us or have performance anxiety problems.
Well, but not only that, but Diane, you have to not just have them say and do things, but on some level, you've got to be feeling what they're going through on some level
mm-hmm.
so that you know what they're going. You can't do it without – you have to go through what they're going through emotionally, not maybe as intensely as they are, but I always did. And when I rewrite my own life, I go through it again on
mm-hmm.
some level. And that's exactly what actors have to do
mm-hmm.
is live emotionally.
That authenticity.
What
yeah.
Yeah. You know, you've got to feel their character's happiness to have them speak their happiness or feel their grief
right.
if they're
absolutely. And if you don't, it comes across as inauthentic
that's
or
right.
shallow. I mean, whichever.
Because you're not merely writing about joy; you're writing about their joy, their unique,
mm-hmm.
inimitable. What is it like when they're happy? The specificity of it—that's what you're seeking, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly right.
And how can you write it if you can't feel it as accurately or closely as you can?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting experience to be at a book group or a reading, whatever, and people start to tell you about your characters.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
to think that, and usually they get them, and there is no right. Those characters become whatever the reader interprets them to be, but sometimes they get it really right. And you think, how in the heck did I make that happen? You know, basically with words, you have the dirt and a stick. It's about as low tech as you can get. And with those tools, you somehow make a living person, a being, and hand it off to somebody else. I will never get used to the fact that that's possible at all. It's fabulous.
Isn't it fantastic? I just think it's fantastic. I mean, that... when you write something, I was just talking about, I was actually talking about those high school kids today about this and how reading is an imaginative act, how when you read, you have to imagine what is happening. And in that way, those characters become theirs because they're imagining them too. They're filling in details that you couldn't write. They have to, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't give
mm-hmm.
them everything. And so it comes to life within them, and it is theirs at that point. It's not your book anymore. It becomes their book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if they any reader does not engage with their character, your characters, it's not going to work. The book is not going to work, at least for that reader. And I wonder sometimes. I mean, it's been 1,000 years since I was in a high school English class as a student, but I always felt that the book was what it was going to be. It was done. It was whole. You read it as kind of an onlooker, but you didn't really engage with it. And it wasn't until college that I realized that's not true at all. I mean, the book is a different thing to every person who reads it, and it's yours to mess with. I mean, basically, as a reader, I have the ability to say, I don't buy it. I don't agree with that. I don't think that's real. I don't think it works for me. And
absolutely.
I get to do that.
Yes. Yes, I mean, the mistake, I think a lot of the way books are taught in particularly high school. I can't remember. I didn't stick around college very long to find out. But in high school is that it is a kind of like that it's complete and this and we're going to tell you sort of what it means. But
right.
In fact, what that book means to you is no one else's business. It's certainly not the writer's business. And, you know, and every writer knows that.
Yeah.
You know, that's between you and you, and that's whatever you are. That's what the book means to you. And that, and
right.
I mean, the perfect story. I love the story about Yann Martell. I interviewed him for the book he wrote after Life of Pi for Beatrice and mm-hmm. Virgil, and he was talking about going around with Life of Pi. He met this woman, and he said to her, she said, "Oh, I love Life of Pi. I love that tiger." He goes, "Oh, thank you." She said, "I know just what that tiger is." And he said, "Oh yeah?" He said, "Yes, it's a marriage." He said, "Really?" Now, of course, he had written, he wanted to be about God and the non-physical and all this sort of thing. That was his idea.
Right.
And she said, "It's a marriage." He goes, "Really?" She said, "Yes, I've been married, and that tiger is a marriage." And he said, "Okay, then. It's a marriage." And he said, "I'm not going to correct her because that's what it was to her. No matter what
right.
I wanted it to be, that's what she brought from it." Now, she would have been wrong, maybe in a class setting, but she wasn't wrong. They're never, your reader is never wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it's absolutely true. And something funny about that has started happening to me. Well, it happened once with Hannah and now with Friday's Harbor. I've been taken to task in no uncertain terms by really furious women. For Hannah, it was that I fed her too much junk food. And she was really upset with me.
Right.
And so we had to talk about that. And in Friday's
yeah.
Harbor, you know, there's a chihuahua named Julio Iglesias, and Julio is allowed to be up on the top of the pool around Friday the killer whale. And I got a nasty note from somebody who was obviously a chihuahua fan who said that it was totally wrong of me to allow that dog to be up on that pool top with a killer whale and not to have it in some way protected. And it was the same feeling. This woman was furious. And I thought, okay, well, in a funny sort of way, there's a backhanded compliment that the whole thing was real enough to those readers that they could take me to task because that emotion had been created in them strongly enough that they needed to unburden themselves. And but
that's
it
right.
was just, it was funny both times. It took me so much by surprise.
You see, this is the amazing thing about writing is that you write it and you've got all these ideas about what it is and all that you want to communicate, and then you've just got to surrender all of that because
mm-hmm.
you have no idea what anyone is going to see, what they're going to – they might get what you intended, but likely as not, they're going to get some other version of it. And you have to just give up the idea that it's
yeah.
your book at that point in a way.
Yeah,
it really
and in fact,
isn't.
I struggled with what to say and whether for the more recent one for Friday's Harbor, whether I needed to – in some way defend myself about making those choices for this chihuahua. And I decided it really doesn't matter. It makes no difference whatsoever what I say. It's what I wrote.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much the end of it. I mean, I had my reasons, you know, but in the end, she just had to tell me what she needed to tell me and then move along. And it wouldn't have mattered at all if I had defended myself, you know, for an hour. She still would have felt that way from the characters in the book that I created. And so I kind of let
yeah.
it go. I thought, well, that's fine.
You know what it reminds me of is how it seems to me a lot of creative people create in one of two ways. You know, one way might be you say, I've read science fiction. I love science fiction. I want to create a book that gives another reader the same great feeling I get when I read these kinds of science fiction books. You know,
right.
I just read, you know, and that's, and so they say, I've had the experience. I want to create more of it. And the other way people create is by saying, everyone has gotten it wrong. This is not the way it should be done. I'm so upset. I'm going to go do it instead. And
mm-hmm.
and we don't think of these sort of negative critical feelings as creative, like this woman
right.
saying to you, her, this is kind of an odd example, but when we see something we don't like, it's us trying to create the thing we do like, but sort of in
right.
reverse.
Right.
You know, so people go and criticize your book for it's not funny enough or there's too much dialogue. What they're really saying is
right.
their little writer self is trying to create their own book, but first they're starting by criticizing yours.
Right. Right.
Does that make sense?
Which is fine, too. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that the most passionate readers often do engage with the writer as they make their way through your book. There is some kind of an interaction with them and the writer by what we've left as our footprints, our characters, the decisions they made, the emotion that they evoke. And I think those people are very skillful readers for the most part.
Yeah.
They can be really daunting, too. I'm not sure,
sure
I would necessarily want to know everything going through a reader's mind as they read my work. But, again, it's a dance. It's a two-person affair. We write, but there has to be somebody on the receiving end eventually, or at least I think so. Actually a lot of people who write and don't care if people read their work, but I think they're still in the minority.
Yeah, but I think that, I feel that you don't want to get caught up in how many people are reading it if you can, and spend all your time thinking about your readership. But the fact is, when you write, you are not writing. This is a weird dance. I've talked to a lot of writers about this recently. But you're writing what's inside you and looks interesting to you and pleases
mm-hmm.
you. But you're writing it in a way so that another human being can see why it's interesting, funny, profound, sexy, whatever. So in a way,
mm-hmm.
you're both concerned only with yourself and with those other people. And that
yeah.
you are trying to write it so someone else can understand it. That's the whole pleasure. You're not writing in some
right.
little, some Esperanza, some strange language that you can understand. No, you're trying to put it down so someone else gets it. They're not just notes to yourself.
Right, right. And something comes to mind about a week ago here in St. Paul. I did a book event, a reading for Fridays Harbor, and there was a woman there who had been part of a writing group for 10 years, and they met weekly. Think about
wow.
that. That's an amazing.
Wow.
And they weren't published. None of them were published, though that was
right.
the end game. I mean, they still were hoping that that would happen. But in the meantime, I think that they needed each other to witness the creative process and
yeah.
to consume the output, essentially, in order to keep them going. And I think that's why a lot of writers' groups begin when they're junior writers, craft-wise especially,
yeah.
is you need somebody there to read and what you've done, and if nothing else, say, good for you. I've
yeah.
read it, I've received it, atta girl, atta boy, this is important and you're doing it. I think that
yeah.
that matters to people.
Absolutely. We write to share something that we love with someone else, You said you wrote you love your characters, and you have to love your story. And the best
mm-hmm.
thing to do with anything you love is to give it away,
mm-hmm.
It's true. I mean, love
That's
isn't meant to be just kept all bottled up in you.
Yeah. Somebody asked me about 2 weeks ago what the greatest compliment was that I could receive about any of my books. And I said the greatest compliment of all is to hear somebody say, I just gave your book to somebody as a present. And I thought, wow, I mean, that's really, you liked it enough to pass it on. Well, in some ways, does that person then have to love your work enough to love it themselves to pass it on to a loved
right.
one? I mean, it's kind of a mind-boggling thing, but it definitely was my answer, is that is the highest compliment I can imagine.
What a fantastic note on which to end our conversation. Diane, best of luck. It's Friday's Harbor, available everywhere, yes?
Yes, everywhere.
All right. Well, good luck with it, Diane, and write the next one, and we're going to talk again, okay?
I hope so. It's always a pleasure, Bill.
Okay, Diane, good luck.
Thanks.
Well, yes. Write something you love and share it. How much better can it get than that? What else do we want but to share what we love, to share what we love with the ones we love? Life is just one big expansion of love. And so that's why I always end my show by saying to remember to write what you love, love what you love, do what you love. Can't go wrong. Jasper Ford next week, science fiction writer.